from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Thuy Vu, in for Michael Krasny. $1 trillion, that's the amount Americans owe when it comes to student loans. And starting July 1st, it might get worse when the interest rate for subsidized student loans doubles unless Congress takes action. We talk with experts about ways to manage your school debt, with a congressman looking to lower the interest rate, and with a group that gets alumni to make loans to current students. Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Thuy Vu, in today for Michael Krasny. When we think about personal debt, the first thing that usually comes to mind is mortgages. But there's another kind of debt crisis looming close behind, and that is student loans. A recent study by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York found student debt almost tripled between 2004 and 2012. That debt is now approaching $1 trillion. Meanwhile, interest rates on federal student loans are set to double this summer unless Congress steps in. This morning, we're talking with experts about options for dealing with these staggering debts. Our guests are East Bay Congressman George Miller, who's the senior Democrat of the House Education and Workforce Committee; Jason Delisle, director of the Federal Education Budget Project for the New America Foundation; and Nancy Coolidge, student financial support coordinator with the University of California's Office of the President. Welcome to you all.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. Congressman Miller, can you explain, I'll begin with you, can you explain the legislative deadline that is coming up in July? Why are interest rates on federal subsidized student loans set to jump?
Well, it'd be set to jump because we extended this last year. The current 3.4% interest rate would jump to 6.8% interest if the Congress does nothing. And last year, the Congress, I think rightfully so, decided that in the middle of a recession, with the job market as difficult as it is and people struggling to go back to school for new skills and learning, that to raise that interest rate was just counterproductive. And I would hope that the Congress would continue to view it this year. I think as we now start for the first time to see the economy perhaps making sustained growth, albeit not what we'd like, that this just isn't the time to jump the interest rates. And when we see the federal government loaning the largest banks in the world essentially free money, why would we put this increased interest rates on the back of people who are struggling to acquire new skills to gain an education so they can participate in this new cycle of growth?
And do you think there is momentum right now among Congress and from the president to actually act and keep this from doubling?
I would hope so. I think there will be. I think when they look at it, and I'm not saying that this should be a perpetual situation, I think it may be that people decide that we can do this another year, but we want to change the formula going forward. There's been a lot of discussion on our committee about a variable rate with the cap or without a cap, but to reduce that cost to the federal government, but not trap. At the other end of the spectrum, you don't want to trap students with high interest rates that make repayment even more difficult for them. So, we're sort of sorting through. Jason, who's on the phone call today, and others testified in the committee 10 days ago about some options that we would have.
And since you mentioned Jason Delisle, let's bring you in at this point. You did testify, and you put out a lengthy report about some options. What are some of the top options that you think could be put in place to help solve this crisis?
Well, on the interest rate side, right now the rates are essentially set at nominal levels in law, so they're not really based on anything. Which is why you have this sort of concern about, hey, interest rates have come down on other types of debt. Why haven't they moved on student loans? And so you could essentially make the interest rate on student loans based on some sort of market index, but still set the rate below market so that people are getting low rates when rates are low. Of course, what happens when you do that is you have to charge them high rates when rates are high. That's one of the consequences of making the interest rates based on something.
And, you know, we're talking a lot about numbers and finances, but there's a true human cost to this, isn't there? How does this debt crisis, $1 trillion now, affects the economy overall when young people are saddled with huge payments that they can't afford to repay?
Well, I think, you know, that's the concern of many of us in the Congress, that we not have a situation where student loans become a drag on the rest of the economy and cause, students between the ages of 20 and 35, what have you, postpone a lot of other decisions they might ordinarily make in their life, to form a family, to have children, to buy a house. And that all gets very difficult with the student debt. Over the years, we've tried to make that debt more manageable and more affordable. But what we haven't conquered is the driver of that debt, which is the dramatically increasing cost of college, whether they be nonprofits or public institutions, or certainly even the private sector colleges that have driven a huge amount of debt over this last 10 years. That coupled with a recession unlike any of people in our generation have seen, drove millions of people back to college to try to gather those new skills because their job disappeared or their job was going to require additional talents. So 5 million people showed up at community colleges that we hadn't seen before over the last couple of years. So there's a lot of stress in the system, and at the same time, certainly with the public institutions, the states have walked away from their obligations because of the recession, because of increased cost in health care costs that drive state budgets. And they offloaded a lot of this onto students and parents through forced borrowing to get that education.
Now, Congressman Miller, you brought up an interesting point that private sector colleges have really driven up the debt. Jason, your perspective on that, why is that? Is that because they have higher default rates than other types of colleges and universities?
I'm sorry. Could you say the question again? Debt is going up where?
Congressman Miller made an interesting point in that he said that the private sector colleges are really driving up the debt. And I'm wondering why that is. Is that because they have a higher default rate than other kinds of colleges and universities?
Well, I mean, they don't have any subsidy on the tuition side, so people are borrowing more to pay at those schools because the price that they're setting is essentially the price, unlike a community college that's getting a subsidy from a state or local government or a state university that's getting some sort of appropriation or per-student tuition assistance amount. So the price you see at a for-profit college is essentially what they're charging. That's the full price, and you have to borrow to get it. Another thing that pushes up the borrowing amount at for-profit colleges is that the federal government allows people who are independents, so they aren't dependent on their parents anymore, to borrow considerably more than people who are dependents. And so those people attending for-profit colleges tend to be people who are independents, and they can access a lot more in federal loan limits. So, for example, in your second or third year, you could borrow $12,000 as opposed to a dependent undergraduate who could only borrow $7,500. So we add those two things together, and it's easy to see how there are much higher debt levels at those types of institutions.
Okay. We're discussing student loan debt and how students can either manage it or avoid it entirely. The current student loan debt totals $1 trillion. It's an extraordinary amount, and that may increase starting July 1st when the interest rate for subsidized student loans doubles or may double to nearly 7% unless Congress acts. We're joined by a panel of experts. George Miller is the U.S. Congressman representing the 11th District of California in the East Bay. He's also the senior Democrat of the House Education and Workforce Committee. Jason Delisle is the director of the Federal Education Budget Project at the New America Foundation. And also Nancy Coolidge is in the studio with us. She's a coordinator for federal and state programs on student financial support at the Office of the President, the University of California. If you'd like to join our conversation, Call us at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. And in particular, if you have a debt that is saddling you right now and you quite don't know what to do about it, here's the time to get some advice. Give us a call. Nancy Coolidge, I want to bring you in at this point because the Federal Reserve Bank of New York study that I mentioned earlier, they had a really astounding finding that nearly 18% of borrowers now have student loan debts ranging from $25,000 to $50,000. That's an incredible amount.
It is a lot of money. Borrowers in the past typically did not borrow this much, and the amounts that they borrowed didn't result in quite as big debt because the interest that accrued when they were in school and the interest that they were charged during repayment was not as steep as 6.8. Before 2006, the interest rates, at least for a period, were indexed, as Jason was pointing out, to a known quantity in the commercial market, such as a treasury bill or LIBOR, or there was some indexing foundation. And more recently, it's simply been a statutory straight a flat 6.8. It's a fixed interest rate, which students in that time wanted. They chose a flat so they could predict with more certainty what they would be getting. Obviously, they did not anticipate that interest rates would fall so and that they would then be paying much higher than market rates. 6.8 is an extraordinarily high amount if you consider that this is a government program.
So is it a good idea then to tie interest rates to market rates, which is something that Jason Delisle has suggested?
Mm-hmm. Well, all along, at least at our institution and many others like us, we prefer to keep students in variable rates and manage those the spikes that Jason was referring to where it could go up very high with a cap so that we would set a cap. 6.8, for example, was proposed as the cap at the time. We would say perhaps the interest rate would be set at 90-day T-bill plus 3, never to exceed 6.8. We thought that was a desirable option. But there was a big desire at the time for a flat rate, a fixed rate, and that was what Congress did do.
How about if you flipped the model? What about instead of subsidizing on the front end, you focus on the back end? That is, students who make more after they graduate, pay more, and those who can't repay are subsidized. Is that workable?
And to some extent, that is already beginning to occur because the repayment models that the federal law includes these days has in it provisions for people who do not earn a great deal. There's two pieces. Well, there was always, not always, but since the early, in the mid-90s, they established one called the Income Contingent Repayment Plan. And since then, they've improved it with the Income-Based Repayment Plan, which went into effect several years ago. And now there's a really new one called the Pay As You Earn, which is a much more attractive version of IBR, which is Income-Based Repayment. And so the federal government is beginning to subsidize borrowers on the back end, in addition to the small subsidy that goes to undergraduates only. This 3.4% that could jump up to 6.8 currently applies only to undergraduates who demonstrate financial need. It has not, for 2 years, applied to graduate students, professional degree students, or others who are not demonstrating financial need. So the rate has already gone to 6.8 for almost all these other borrowers.
And Congressman Miller, I know that your committee has been looking into this issue because you don't want to just take it in a piecemeal way. You want a broader approach. How are you doing on that?
Well, that's the discussions we're having, and I think we're making headway on it. I mean, we have to remember that the basis of this program, the social purpose here, is to provide access to young people to opportunities at higher education. And obviously that universe includes many people who do not have family wherewithal in terms of financing available to them to go to college. And so there are elements of risk here. And I think that, we have an opportunity to work out the financing and to make it affordable and to justifiably do that based upon the social contract here that this country is better off with a better educated population engaged in higher education. Does that mean everybody wins the job of their dream? No, it doesn't. But the fact of the matter is, we know that when you do complete your college degree, that your weekly earnings are going to be much higher than a person with a high school diploma. And that the borrowing, for a community college, is about $3,000, and for a 4-year school, it runs about around $7,000 a year. What we also need is better information for the borrowers, how to be a smart borrower. It may be that in your first year of college, you don't get to move out of your house and go rent an apartment and borrow money for your cost of living. It may be you're going to have to commute. In California, we have an incredible network of community colleges and state colleges that are readily accessible to students. Not to every student, but that's there. People are going to have to be more strategic about their borrowing. They need better information. Many students are borrowing from the private sector unaware that this is not a government, this is not the student loan program of the federal government. We've gone through some pretty big scandals in these programs, both in the public sector and in the private sector. We tried to weed those out, but this is a very valuable program for future economic growth in this country, and to have the workforce that everybody claims that we're going to need and that we're not yet producing because of students not participating significantly enough in higher education and getting the benefits of that. So there's a lot of moving pieces here, and the Congress is just one part of it. We're the financing agency. But, when you see students borrow money and go to a school and then find out that the course that they took at the community college at Diablo Valley College doesn't transfer to San Jose State or to San Francisco State, and now they have to borrow more money to retake that course for a reason that nobody can really articulate to you why that course wasn't acceptable for transfer and for graduation. I mean, there's a lot of pieces here that have to be worked out to streamline this process of education so it serves the students and the families who are now borrowing money. When I went to school, we weren't borrowing money. But now families are. And that changes how everybody has to look at this. It changes the cost of college that people have been reluctant to look at but must look at now. It changes the idea that the state can just continue to withdraw resources from their public institutions and somehow parents and students borrowing that money can make up for that.
Yeah,
there's some assumptions that have been taking place here over the last 6 or 8 years that are very dangerous in terms of the cost of college.
You mentioned that you didn't have to borrow when you went to college. I had to borrow, but my era was so different from today. I mean, I went to Cal through a combination of Pell Grants and Work Study Grants, and there's just no way, I don't think, that I could afford college today.
I came here as a ref. I went to California Law School at Davis for $95 a quarter.
Okay? Well,
that's now a $50,000 journey.
Yeah. I went to Cal, majored in rhetoric, and I came here as a refugee from Vietnam, so my family had no money, and I don't know that I could afford college at today's prices. But let me go to the phone lines, because we have quite a few people lined up who want to weigh in on this. And let's say hello to Kathy in Santa Clara. Good morning and welcome to Forum.
Good morning. And I had a question, but your last speaker just raised an issue that I want to make a comment on. I work for a community college, and one of the things that is being done that greatly smooths the transition from community colleges to the CSUs was the passage of SB 1440 and the development of transfer degrees. I know that down in the South Bay, all of our community colleges have a number of these degrees in different majors. Mission College has something like 10 or 11 now, and I know the other community colleges in the area have many. And students who take these degrees are guaranteed admission to CSU, and they're guaranteed that all their units will transfer. Now, my question was to ask about the role of the for-profit colleges in a different sense than your speakers have addressed. I know that I've read in the Chronicle of Higher Ed that there have been investigations into practices of for-profit universities and colleges raising their tuition rates when the federal financial aid regulations change so that their students are guaranteed to qualify for the maximum amount of financial aid profit, so that in effect, the federal government is subsidizing the for-profits the way the states are subsidizing state colleges by being put in a position where their financial aid is constantly being maxed out and going to these for-profit institutions. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Kathy, thank you for that. And I'm going to let Nancy answer that because, boy, the minute you brought up the role of for-profit schools, she lit up. There was a fire lit up under her seat. She practically jumped out of her seat. You have a strong opinion about this.
Well, I think for years there's been a struggle as to what constitutes a quality option for students. I think Congress has really grappled. The Department of Education has truly tried. But the powerful lobbyists who represent publicly traded institutions and for-profit with single-owner institutions have been very successful at preventing the regulation, much as Wall Street regulation has been very, very difficult to bring about. Regulation of this sector, this for-profit sector, has been very, very difficult. And what we're facing is that just as Congressman Miller said, the federal taxpayers are actually subsidizing stockholders in private businesses. And the students are just the vehicle for getting that profit. And the attempts to regulate it, which I think have been heartfelt, and right now there's a rule called the 90-10 rule. It used to be the 85-15 rule, and it's the 90-10 rule. And it means that the operating budget of these for-profit institutions, they have to demonstrate that at least 10% of it comes from other than Title IV federal money. Now, that doesn't include the money from the Veterans Administration, which many of them enroll many veterans. That only includes the Title IV, this program that we're discussing today. And frankly, that's 10% of all the money. There's hardly anyone paying their own money to go to these places. Almost all the money coming to these institutions is coming from students who take out loans. And we wonder why it's $1 trillion.
And essentially coming from the taxpayers.
From the taxpayers. Well. That's right.
Okay. Josh, in Oakland, welcome to Forum. What would you like to ask our panelists?
A comment. Maybe they could chime in. Maybe they have something to say about it. So I'm a transfer student over at San Francisco State, and I had to opt out of getting a BM and be okay with getting a BA because I couldn't afford to take out any more loans to continue if I wanted to get a BM, because it would take a lot longer for me. So I think what a lot of students are having a problem with, because I've talked with other students, they're coming up with the same problem, is that they have to cut their college career short because they can't afford to take any more loans than they already have.
Okay.
So I want to know, is that a common problem that they're seeing?
Well, let me let Nancy answer that, since she sees a lot of this in her office.
When you say you had to change your program goals because you couldn't borrow more, were you maxed out in terms of like $31,000 for a dependent undergraduate?
No, the amount of money that I started to borrow in loans,
mm-hmm.
it got so much to the point where I didn't want to have to be in such high debt I get out.
You made a choice, sir. You made a choice to, which very wisely you said, is this really worth it to me? Am I going to earn enough to warrant having gone into debt to this extent? So you made a different choice about what you were going to do. Is that what I'm hearing?
It sounds like
right.
It. Okay.
Right. Well,
Josh?
I kind of felt like I had to, because if I continued, then I would incur a lot more debt. And
okay.
Since the interest rates are going a lot higher, I was worried.
So you had to make some really tough choices. Josh in Oakland, thanks for joining us. We're going to continue our conversation about the rising rate of student loans and how to manage your school debt after the half hour. But I wanted to say goodbye to Congressman George Miller and thank him for his time for being in our first half hour. And also thank Jason Delisle with the Federal Education Budget Project for joining us as well. We'll be back after the break with more. I'm Twee Vu, in for Michael Krasny. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Tui Vu, in for Michael Krasny. We're discussing student loans and how the interest rate for subsidized student loans will double starting July 1st if Congress doesn't act. Joining us is Nancy Coolidge, Coordinator for Federal and State Programs on Student Financial Support at the Office of the President for the University of California. And we're also joined now in this half hour by Mike Cagney, the co-founder and CEO of SoFi, a group which connects students and alumni through a social community lending pool. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Mike, thanks for joining us. Let's start with you. You're trying to introduce a private market element as an alternative to federal loans. How do your loans work?
Sure. It's a basic concept where we connect students and recent graduates with alumni and other community investors through dedicated school-specific lending funds. The borrowers are receiving a lower loan rate relative to their direct and plus options. The alumni are earning a market rate return, and both sides are benefiting from the connections formed. And we do a lot to facilitate connections, interaction, whether it be from career mentoring to financing early stage entrepreneurial endeavors. We believe that the tighter and more cohesive that community, the better not only the underlying credit, but the value to both the borrower and the lender.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you offer better interest rates and with some support from your alumni networks to the borrowers.
That's right. So we tend to do a lot of work around refinancing folks who have graduated, and we refinance at a 5.99% interest rate with no origination fees versus the 6.8% direct and 7.9% plus rates that most of our borrowers are paying.
What are the challenges of this? Are you finding enough interest?
Sure. We've done about $100 million in lending last year, and we're on track to do about $1 billion of lending this year. We've been generating substantial economic savings to the borrowers, but one of the big motivations of folks participating in our program has been the community and the platform. And being able to have a relationship with a group of investors that aren't only invested in your in the economic success of the outcome, but also in the social success is very powerful. And we're finding it's a message that people are resonating with.
Okay. And this is such a big issue because the cost of college has been increasing at an average of 8% per year for the past 30 years. That's much higher than the inflation rate. People are graduating saddled with huge debts. We have a lot of people on the line who want to figure out how to make this situation work for them. So I'm going to return to the phone lines here and begin with Andy in Palo Alto. Welcome to Forum.
Thank you very much, and thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask your guests to consider whether or not loans are really, in fact, a form of financial aid. We talk about grants, we Pell Grants, scholarships, and loans. But loans have to be paid back, and my question is, do they not possibly simply serve to obfuscate the true cost of college? I mean, as for instance, if I go and buy an overpriced car, and this car salesman says, well, we're car costs $40, but we'll give you a loan for it, I'm still paying the $40. And does the easy availability of this serve to prevent the market from driving down the cost of education? I mean, the easy availability of the loans.
Good question. Nancy?
Andy, we have grappled with this. There is obviously an elasticity, an economic elasticity created by the availability of loans. But as Congressman Miller earlier mentioned, the point of these programs is access. These programs are designed to give individuals who could not otherwise attend college the opportunity to do so. And we have to balance that need for access with the moral hazard that is presented by the relatively easy availability of credit for this. And I just want to suggest to you that while institutions do show discounts, we also publish what we call our net price. And the net price is what you're talking about. We always put right out there for the student to see the net price of attendance. And that involves how much grant and scholarship and any free money you're getting, and that's subtracted from the cost of attending our institution, which is the real price. It doesn't involve loans. It doesn't involve work study because you have to earn that by working. So to your point, we actually represent net price so that borrowers or potential borrowers can look across institutions and see, if I pick institution A versus institution B, my net price will be different, even though it looks similar once I take out the loans. So I think we are aware of the hazard we present to individuals, and we try not to do what you're talking about, which is the overpriced car, making it seem as though it's not costly. If anything, I think we are trying to emphasize, look, you're making an investment here. You are going to think about, is this worth it to me, either because I will earn more or because I will gain other social and personal benefits from having undertaken this expensive experience?
Mike Cagney of SoFi, do you want to add anything to that?
Sure. I think to some points that Nancy made earlier, one of the challenges in student lending and one of the reasons why we've seen the explosion in the amount that people have been borrowing is the easy availability of credit. And the challenge is that there's no accountability back to the school that commensurates that the graduates of that program can pay back the debt they incur. And so it creates an agency problem where the school is incented to charge a particular tuition, particularly for for-profit private colleges where that tuition's revenue. And the borrower can borrow up to need. And whether they're directly borrowing up to need in a independent situation or they're doing it through Parent Plus in a dependent situation, there's actually no limit on the dollar amount that that borrowing can take in the form of PLUS loans. And so you create a dichotomy where, as a school, I can charge whatever tuition I need. I say, this is the cost. People borrow up to that dollar amount. I get paid. If in a quarter you drop out or in 4 years you graduate but you can't pay your loan, there's no recourse back to the institution. And I think the problem there is it creates a situation where the value of the education doesn't necessarily commensurate to the cost. And that's what's led to a much higher inflation rate in education than in the broader inflation rate for the country and one of the biggest challenges we face in the student lending crisis right now.
And that's sort of related to a comment we received on the web from Kurt. And Kurt writes, is this the next bubble? If you cannot find a job that gives you a salary generous enough to pay off your loan, then you are underwater. How many students are walking away? And those who are walking away, where are they going? This is sort of reminiscent of the mortgage crisis, isn't it?
It's not so much in the sense that the mortgage crisis was a particular situation where levered financial institutions had large amounts of mortgage paper that in hindsight ended up being, in many cases, fraudulent paper that caused a collapse of the financial system. In this circumstance, the government's the one that's on the hook. And I think that the cost of the government is yet to be determined. One thing that's very clear is if you look at the student loan portfolio and student loan pool that the government has today, there's a very large percentage of that outstanding loan balance that isn't in what's called current pay. Those are folks that are in some kind of forbearance or forgiveness or deferment. And it's very unclear when the government books a student loan today, they actually book the present value of that loan as income, if you will, into the budget. But they realize that over time, it's very unclear what will happen if the realization of revenue from these loans doesn't actually foot with the amount that the government books up front. And what happens to the government in that situation? Because they'll face a shortfall, and that shortfall would have to be addressed through either cutting spending or raising incremental taxes or potentially raising loan rates on existing loans. And it's unclear how this plays out.
Right now, the government is actually realizing revenue from the borrowers who do repay at 6.8% and at 7.9% for graduate PLUS loans. So at the moment, they have a positive cash flow, even considering all the defaults that Mike just mentioned. And while it's true that in the future it may shift, that is not the case now. They're charging students, both poor and not-so-poor students, so much in interest rates that they're realizing a positive cash flow on the federal side.
We have some questions about their personal debts from listeners of the program who emailed to us. And Carly writes, I am a part-time music teacher at a public school and have received a layoff notice, and I have a massive student loan debt. My private student loan debt payments are nearly $1,000 a month. My lender is inflexible in terms of repayment options. The only way I can lower my payment is to continue taking college courses to qualify for an in-school deferment and then pay what I am able. I am unable to consider buying my own home or starting a family. It is simply not financially viable. And Betsy writes, my husband and I have combined student loans in the amount of $215,000. While my portion of the student loan is locked in at 3.25%, my husband's $115,000 loan is locked in back in the 90s at 8.5%. We have a total payment of about $1,400 per month. It's killing us. They've tried to reduce their interest rates. It's not working. And she says most help is for current borrowers and completely ignores borrowers who locked back in the 90s. Do you have any financial advice for them? How can they address this?
To the extent that some of their loans are not private, to the extent that they have public, that is, Stafford loans in the mix or perhaps Grad Plus loans in the mix, they are good candidates given what they're doing. They may qualify for income-based repayment, which would be available to people who even borrowed back then, even if they've consolidated their loans. They could approach the federal servicers and seek to have their loans placed into a different repayment plan, which is not doesn't take into account how much they have borrowed. It only looks at the amount that they earn and how much they can afford to pay. To the extent that they have private student loans in that mix, they are completely at the mercy of the private lenders, and they are not eligible to include any of those loans in a bankruptcy, even if they chose to do so. I'm not suggesting they are or they would, but the law is very firm that the private lenders are protected right now, and students who have too much debt and should otherwise be eligible to discharge them in bankruptcy cannot do so. That's a law we would like to see changed.
Well, and that applies to government loans as well. They're also non-dischargeable or generally non-dischargeable. And I think that
however, they have income-based repayment that allows them much, much longer terms than the 10 years or whatever the original term was. So there's a way to get every borrower into a repayment plan that they can afford in the federal programs.
We're discussing student loan debt here on Forum and how students can either manage it or avoid it entirely. And in the studio with me is Nancy Coolidge, Coordinator for Federal and State Programs on Student Financial Support at the Office of the President for the University of California. And also joining us by phone is Mike Cagney, the co-founder and CEO of SoFi. It's a group that connects students and alumni through a social community lending pool. Let's return to the phone lines now and speak with John in Petaluma. Welcome to Forum.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. My dilemma is that I took out a student loan in the 90s, from 95 to 98, and I was told that this was for a PhD, and I was told that if I worked with at-risk children, I was working with juvenile hall, that I would get a forgiveness of 50%. So someone came up with an arbitrary year as 1998, so I don't qualify. And I'm wondering, is there anyone out there who is in the same situation with this dilemma? Because I did go in, worked in juvenile hall, got my hours for a PhD, but I still have the loan because it was cut off at 98. Is there any advice you can give me on this?
Again, I think that you sound like if you've got a big loan and you're working in the public sector, you may be eligible for what's called public loan forgiveness, which is a different offer than the one that was snatched from your hands at that time. And you may have already, you would need to go and arrange your loan so that you are paying in the income-based repayment plan, and then you would have to make 120 months of full-time employment in the nonprofit sector, during which you are making payments in the IBR, the income-based repayment plan, after which any balance you still owe would be forgiven and would not be taxed because you had earned that forgiveness. So that's available to borrowers, even borrowers as far back as you're talking about.
Our number, once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 866-733-6786. Again, it's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. And I wanted to ask you this. What is the best approach here? Some kind of public-private partnership? Is that a possibility?
The University of California, we have made a strenuous attempt to make sure that what we cost and how much aid we have available in the form of grants and scholarships and gift aid, we call it, is such that borrowers only need to borrow what we call a manageable amount, that they will never exceed the $31,000 maximum that's available from the federal student loans. We do not encourage any borrower who has any option, like a federal loan, to take out a private loan. We consider private loans very high risk. So no, we're not looking for a public-private relationship. We believe the federal program, with its back end and its front end, in a few cases subsidies, is really the best way to go. However, we have students who don't qualify. International students don't qualify, for example. So there's certain students do need private loans. but we are not convinced that the current marketplace and the current rules surrounding those is the best for students.
Mike Cagney, how would you like to respond?
Sure. We're actually a preferred private lender for the University of California system for the graduate business programs, and we've done tens of millions of dollars of lending
into
those programs.
And you stopped making new loans in the middle of the school year, and you are no longer on our preferred lender list.
We didn't stop making new loans. We continue to fund the loans that we've committed into. And
you didn't make new loans, sir, and we don't have you on our list anymore.
Okay. Well, we did make new loans, and we continue to make new loans, and we continue to refinance folks who have graduated out of the program. And in terms of the protections of the loans, if you look at what we deal with income-based repayment, economic hardship forbearance, we offer much of the same protections that a borrower gets off of a federal loan. What we don't offer is forgiveness, which is a challenge for us to do as a private lender. But what we have done is save borrowers upwards of $10,000 per borrower to refinance their loans with us. And that's a meaningful savings. I mean, you couple that with the connection into the community, I think it's a very compelling value proposition. And the context of income-based repayment, and we talk about this with all our borrowers because it's a very important fact, you're potentially reducing your per monthly payment, but you're not necessarily reducing the cumulative interest that you pay over the life of the loan. And you want to go into that understanding what your total payments are and what economically is most advantageous for you.
There's no question that a longer term costs a borrower more, sir. However, do you allow borrowers to have 15 or 20 years if they need it in order to make the payments and not default?
Well, by default, we have a 15-year loan, so we're starting off with 15. And then there's various circumstances of deferral that a borrower can get, whether they're going back to school or whether they're going through economic hardship forbearance. So, yeah, the loan can extend out to 20 years.
The federal loans do allow 25 in order that borrowers avoid default. But he's right about a value proposition. If borrowers have the means to pay, the private sector can offer them, at this point, better interest rates than the federal loan programs do. He's correct about that.
Okay. Well, you both obviously have a strong disagreement on public versus private loans here. Let me move the conversation along and return to the phone lines and speak with Olivia in San Francisco. Thanks for joining us here on Forum.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have about 4 years of graduate student loan debt, and every month I make a payment of approximately $2,000 towards my student loan payment. It's a combination of private and federal loans. And I was wondering about whether anything would be done in terms of a deduction for student loan interest that's paid over the year. I believe it's right now it's capped at $2,500, and if you make over a certain amount, you don't qualify for that deduction. So I was wondering if anything was being done to increase that amount and take the income contingency off, and I can take my answer off air.
Yeah, there's no statutory or regulatory plan to alter the tax deduction maximum that you just expressed. I believe that will remain the maximum. I don't think there's any congressional interest in that at this point. The House obviously is not interested in providing any more benefits to individuals who have incomes over the $60,000, which I believe is the maximum associated with the eligibility for the deduction.
All right, she's off the air, so we will go on to the next caller, and let's say hello to Verns in San Leandro. Good morning. Verns, are you still there? All right. How about Danielle in Fairfield? Welcome to Forum.
Hello.
Hello. Do you have a question?
Yes, I am calling. My name is Danielle, and I graduated in the early 90s with massive amounts of loans that are now at 8% interest. And I went to the community college to do that, always working full-time or part-time. But I wanted to address the congressman's comment about taking out loans in order to pay for the cost of living while you're in school, and how he had said, well, maybe these people should be living at home instead of taking out the cost of living as part of their loan. I don't think that was a very realistic solution, in that when you are in college and you're working even part-time, you still need some time off from a 40-hour, 50-hour a week job to be studying. And so part of the cost of my school loans, because my tuition was much lower in the late 80s and early 90s, was for cost of living in order to be in my classes and be studying to get my science degree from UC Davis. And I had no funding from family members. I had no money coming in from anyone else. And so I am thankful that I could take that out, even though the interest rate is killing me right now. I teach at the community college now, and I repeatedly hear the students' cries for not enough money for their tuition, much less the book cost. Our publishers are highway robbery at this point with the school loans. And the solutions, while I'm like Jerry Brown's biggest fan of all, his solution in having it paid for differently does nothing but promote grade inflation that is already rampant. Mm. So there's a lot more to this issue than simply people wanting to take out money for cost of living to go to school. I mean,
well, Danielle, you're at a community college now dealing with students, so you're obviously in the thick of it. Nancy or Mike, do you, either one of you, have anything to add?
I'm delighted that you had the opportunity to go to college, and I concur with the idea. I don't think Congressman meant no one should borrow for cost of living, and certainly your situation paid off if you're an instructor or a professor now at a community college. I salute you, and you have a degree. And it is unfortunate. One of the things we're looking at, Jason was on earlier, Jason Delisle from the New America Foundation, talked about indexing student loans, and what can happen is they can go up to 8%. And one of the things we're concerned about is, in addition to putting variable rate interest rates in place and a cap on them, we're also interested in trying to even out what students pay across years, because some students have the good luck to go to college when the interest rates are very low. And then, like you, Danielle, they go when they're very high. And so we're interested in making a more equitable arrangement for federal student loans, so that just because you went when they were high or just because you went when they were low, you aren't stuck for 20 years with that to have to repay. There should be a greater sharing of interest rate and flattening of interest rate across those experiences. And we're not sure. There are some suggestions besides just indexing loans that would achieve some of that equity across years. And I think that would have helped you if we had had that in place then.
Okay, well, the phone lines are lighting up. I want to try to get through as many people as I can. Let's say hello to Shadi in San Francisco. You're on Forum.
Good morning. Yes, I graduated from law school back in 2000, and I did a postgraduate and LLM as well. On top of that, I had upwards of $150,000, and I've hit two economic downturns that have led to loss of job, lower income, so on and so forth. I managed to pay my private loans off in 2000 because at that time the interest rates were at 7-8, hovering at 7-8%. Of course, now they're the lower ones. And my federal got locked in at 5.7 during my grace period due to a very, very good salesperson who talked me into consolidating early. But all of that aside, it's been a huge burden. At this point, I have two questions. One is, are there any considerations for cost of living with respect to repayment? Because obviously someone living in Idaho and someone living in San Francisco have different expenses, yet they are on the same scale of repayment. And my follow-up question is, are there any forgiveness programs for people in the private sector? I now have a family, and obviously that my income has to be distributed differently.
There are some opportunities available to you. They are not as desirable as if you were in the nonprofit sector, because you cannot get forgiveness after 10 years of work while repaying in an income-based loan. But you can still get an income-based repayment plan. You can still make smaller payments for a longer period of time. And as Mr. Cagney pointed out, that will probably cost you more over the longer term, but it'll nevertheless allow you to have greater flexibility with your family finances in the short run, which is you've got children and you've got a family now. There are no provisions in the federal law, either on the financial aid awarding side or on the repayment side, that take into account the cost of living differences across the country. That has been strictly prohibited by members of the Senate, actually, who have no desire to see greater equity for families who live in high-cost areas versus those who live in low-cost areas. But we at the University of California have made that a top priority in our attempts to make student aid more fair. And you bring up a point that is very near to near and dear to our hearts. And thank you for doing so. And I encourage you to look into the income-based repayment as a way of perhaps flexing up your current family stress around finances with these remaining federal loans.
Mike, that brings up an interesting point. Does your company, SoFi, offer anything like that, an income-based repayment? Or what happens if someone has trouble repaying?
Sure. It brings up a couple of relevant points. I think the starting point is for graduate programs like law, like MBA programs, what we're seeing is average loan balances in the $90,000 to $150,000 range. So well above what we see in the undergraduate programs. And I think one of the burdens that the financial aid office has in this circumstance is they owe it to the students to explain, if you come into school, if you get if you're pursuing this particular degree or this particular profession, and you want to borrow, this is how much debt you can reasonably take to be able to service those loans. And those conversations, by and large, don't happen today. And so you're getting people coming out with debt loads that are both untenable and aren't commensurating with the value of the education. In terms of the ability to manage the debt, I would say most private lenders, and certainly we do, provide some level of income-based repayment. It's sort of the standard practice. If someone can't make payments, you have to go and work with them to figure out what level they can. But what we also try to do is what we call a community-based forgiveness function, which is we have some alumni who invest, who have particular philanthropic interests, whether it's around clean water or energy resources or so forth, where individuals might come out of school, they might go into a profession that is not going to provide them the ability to pay down the level of debt they've incurred. And there's community-based forgiveness that can be applied in that circumstance. So ways that we're trying to leverage that interaction, that community engagement, as an alternative way to provide debt relief to folks that are pursuing ideas that are of importance to our investors.
Okay. Well, certainly a very spirited hour here. And thank you to all our listeners for writing in to us and also calling in. It was great to hear from all of you. We were joined this hour by Nancy Coolidge, Coordinator for Federal and State Programs on Student Financial Support at the Office of the President for University of California, and by Mike Cagney, the co-founder, CEO, and chairman for SoFi, a group which connects students and alumni through a social community lending pool. And we were also joined earlier by George Miller, the U.S. Congressman representing the 11th District of California in the East Bay. He's also the senior Democrat of the House Education and Workforce Committee, and also joined by Jason Delisle, the director of the Federal Education Budget Project at the New America Foundation. It researches how U.S. education is financed. Thank you all for being a part of our program today, Nancy and Mike.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online help from David Marks. Forum's executive producer is Raul.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.